A brigade commander typically rates 6 battalion commanders, senior rates 30 field grade officers, and 36 company commanders. A unit's mission and the operational environment consumes enough of their time that interactions with the brigade commander is limited to moments of opportunity. Mission command empowers subordinate commanders to exercise disciplined initiative within the commander's intent, allowing battalions and companies to operate autonomously within the set boundaries of their higher headquarters. However, the leader development and counseling should be a face-to-face interaction that provides subordinates time with their leaders in order to glean lessons learned from experience and understand what is expected of them. Today, in the Leaders Huddle, we are talking to a former brigade commander who emulates mission command and is a product of his experiences, ranging from a rifle platoon leader in Germany to chief of the Commander's Initiative Group at U.S. Central Command for General Retired Lord Austin. Today we're talking with Colonel Brian Reed, the current Brigade Tactical Officer at the United States Military Academy and former Brigade Commander of the 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division, about what Brigade Commanders expect from their subordinate company commanders. This is the Leaders Huddle Podcast, Episode 14, What a Brigade Commander Expects from His Subordinate Company Commanders. Welcome to Leaders Huddle Podcast. Through this podcast, our goal is to educate and inspire the current generation of company grade officers through advancing the discussion of leadership, professionalism, and building high-performing organizations. I'm Captain David Wirt, your host for today's episode. With me today co-hosting this episode is Captain Guillermo Wandike. Our guest today is Colonel Brian Reed. Colonel Reed is an infantry officer and a 1989 graduate of West Point. He has served at every level of command to include Battalion Commander, 1st Battalion, 24th Infantry, Striker, and Brigade Commander, 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division. Aside from his tactical assignments, Colonel Reed holds a master's and PhD from the University of Maryland and served as an instructor and assistant professor in the Department of Behavioral Science and Leadership at West Point. His current assignment is Brigade Tactical Officer, United States Corps of Cadets, where his mission is to develop and train cadets through integration of the academy programs to be leaders of character, committed to duty, honor, country, and inspired and prepared.
Sir, welcome to the podcast. It's good to have you here.
I appreciate you guys having me.
So our main focus today is to get your perspective as a former brigade commander on what a brigade commander expects from their company commanders. We want to extend beyond Army command policy and leverage your experience and knowledge to ask questions that are not always clear in regulation or initial counselings. As company commanders, our first exposure to the brigade commander's expectation is usually right before change of command inventories. My brigade commander sat me down, went over 4 pages of notes. I remember trying to write feverishly everything that he said, what I needed to do, questions that I had, and at the same time trying to process it so I could form an intelligent and relevant question to his response. And I think I might have left that meeting with more questions than I had, but luckily my brigade commander made himself very accessible to his company commanders. But then again, there's those that don't have that exposure to the brigade commander. And so, for example, Dave and I, we commanded in the same brigade, the 20th Engineer Brigade, but we had very distinct interactions with our brigade commander, mostly due to geographical constraints. I was right next to the brigade headquarters at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where Dave was with the 11th Engineers down at in Georgia. So we both sat down and tried to think of questions that we initially had in our first 90 days of commands. And these are questions that are relevant to the operational Army now and what we would have asked our brigade commander given the opportunity. So if you're ready, we'll get started.
Yeah, I'm ready to go.
So our first question is on your perspective of leadership and leader development. You have said before that you're a product of your experience. We're products of our experiences and those who have influenced and taken the time to invest time in our development. From leaders in your past, what behaviors or traits do you see in yourself?
That's a good question to start with. When you've been in the Army, I guess as long as I have, you've been affected by quite a few leaders, some good and some not so good. You try to emulate certain behaviors, obviously in the good ones. So when I think right off the top of my head in terms of this question, I think of probably one of my more immediate CGs when I was a brigade commander who talked quite a bit about don't be a hypocrite. Really was getting at was, walk the talk. If you're going to say that fitness is important to you, then be fit. If you're going to say professional development is important to you, then have a good professional development program. So it sounds kind of simple, but you know, I think that's an important trait, frankly, for all of us is you know, walk the talk, don't be a hypocrite. A couple other things that really have affected me in terms of where I see myself now and what I've tried to emulate in terms of behaviors and traits is transparency and trying to be transparent in communication. I mean, information's power, and people want to know what's going on. Sometimes I think it's worthwhile accepting a little bit of risk and being transparent in the information that you're sharing. Another trait or behavior is decision making and the importance A of timely decision making, but B making decisions with the full power of all the facts or as many facts as you can accumulate in the appropriate amount of time. I think the biggest takeaway from that is you don't always need to be very hasteful in terms of making a decision or shoot from the hip. You probably have more time than you realize. And I think the last thing is empower subordinates. People want to be empowered. They want to do their job. I always would say is, you know, I'm not going to tell you how to suck the egg. I can if you want, but I prefer that, you know, you sort of figure out the problem yourself. But that also means that I've got to resource you and give you some left and right limits. So that's just a handful off the top of my head.
Sir, in the intro, we talked about your repertoire of experience going from a rifle platoon leader in Germany to the chief of the Commander's Initiative Group in U.S. CENTCOM. Who would you say has been most influential in your leader development?
Yeah, again, this is kind of a loaded question, given been in the Army for a while, so I've had the opportunity to be around many great leaders. When I think about this, I think of some of the senior leaders that have influenced me over time. My most recent boss, General Austin, worked for him for 2 years, had a phenomenal impact on me in many ways. General Cohn, who just recently sadly passed away, actually he had an influence on me years and years ago as a cadet when he taught me PL-300, and then over time he's been a mentor of mine. General Garrett, who's now the RCENT commander, was my CG, first CG as a brigade commander. He's been very influential. So those are certainly three folks right off the top. I think peers can be influential. I've had many influential peers. I won't mention them all by name for fear of them listening to this and me not mentioning them. But I will tell you that I've been shaped by my relationships with my peers. And then lastly, and certainly not necessarily last because they're last, but last just in order of listing, are the enlisted leaders that I've served with. I've talked to folks quite a bit about them, guys like Frank Graham, Art LaRue, Ray Folks, you know, senior leaders of mine, first sergeants and sergeant majors that taught me the importance of leader teams and commanding as a team. I've talked about my battalion sergeant major before as probably the best soldier I've ever served with. He made me a better battalion commander, and I think that's probably the best thing you can say about your senior enlisted leader is does he make you a better officer? So just a couple thoughts.
That's great. I think what I've seen, and this is why we asked the question, is what products or what behaviors do you see yourself emulating from leaders that have taken the time to influence and invest in your development, is because we have also created not so much skills, but also behaviors that we've learned from other leaders that have influenced us as we've come along in our 8 or 9 years in the military. And we tend to emulate that and put it in our rucksack or our repertoire of behaviors. And sometimes they work, and sometimes they did it better than we could do it. But we keep that because it was effective for us, and we try to make it effective for others. So that was the intent of the question there.
All right, sir, another follow-on question for specifically on leadership and leader development. Commanders are responsible for development of 3 to 4 platoon leaders, an executive officer, platoon sergeants, and their first sergeant. Specifically, what guidance did you give to your company commanders in terms of developing their subordinate leaders, developing themselves, and can you give any advice to those current company commanders that are sitting in the position that have a lot of responsibility and are operating at very high op tempo or high pace?
Yeah, so with what I often would tell my commanders was spend as much time as you can with your officers. And in a high op tempo environment, that doesn't always work out as well as we would would hope. But you can find snapshots of time. You can find, as an example, you can go to breakfast, you can go to lunch. You can obviously put on your training schedule, a scheduled LPD program. But the bottom line is spend as much time with your officers as you can, not just your platoon leaders, but your XO. I mean, collectively, you make yourselves better. But I also used to tell them to focus on developmental opportunities as a command team, as a company commander and a first sergeant, for their command teams, their PLs and their platoon sergeants. You know, several years ago, the striker community had an initiative, if you will, called leader team training. It's something that we did as a battalion commander prior to deploying, and it involved company commanders, first sergeants, on up. And you went through a series of vignettes, if you will, and collectively as a small group of two, you know, you helped to figure out what the solution to the problem was. And, you know, that's something you can certainly do at your company level. I think there's a lot of goodness in doing more things as command teams. But, again, you can find the opportunities. The opportunities exist. I get it. I mean, the pace is insane. It's always been insane. And it will continue to be insane. But that's okay. That's why we do what we do, and why we're so good at it. You can find time.
Sir, I'm curious. Those leader vignettes sound a lot like what Caldol does here with the Leaders Challenge. Were those organically generated developmental opportunities that the brigade staff put together, or were those external resources that we can highlight or point our listeners towards so they can access them as well?
Yeah, so... They're primarily external resources. The Striker Warfighting Forum, and I haven't looked at it admittedly here in a little while, but certainly when I was in command, you know, commanding a Striker Brigade and Striker Battalion, obviously Fort Lewis and the Striker Warfighting Center is your home. But they have a bunch of resources out there, vignette type stuff that were tailored to what we wanted to do. Caldol, same way, and we leveraged Caldol when I was in command, more so as a battalion commander, not quite as much as brigade commander because the focus was a little bit different for what we were trying to get at, but yeah, they exist.
I will definitely look that up and add it to the show notes for the listeners to include it, so if they want to check that out. So, sir, switching gears a little bit to the topic of professional development and broadening. On the topic of professional development for company commanders, what advice and guidance did you give to your commanders about pursuing broadening experiences?
So, you know, having gone to graduate school and sort of had my foot in and out of operational assignments and here teaching at West Point, I absolutely encouraged my officers to seek broadening experiences, to challenge their assumptions, and to get out of their comfort zones. I am a huge fan of graduate school for officers. I think, you know, there's a lot of goodness in it in terms of, A, you know, expanding your intellectual capacity. I think you bring something to the classroom in terms of trying to bridge a civil-military gap. I think you become a better person coming out of that. That's been my experience, and that's why I encourage officers to go. I think at the end of the day, it makes you a better officer, regardless of what you study. Broadening just doesn't have to be graduate school, though. Broadening can be other assignments that are outside of your basic branch. Obviously, coming to West Point to teach or do whatever, going to a joint billet to work in a COCOM or at the Pentagon. Those are other fellowships, things like that. So there are a multitude of broadening experiences that are out there, and I absolutely encourage officers to take part in them.
Sir, on that topic, you have a unique career path that includes both key tactical and academic assignments. How did you apply your academic experience in growing your intellectual capacity, specifically some of your research on sociology, to your operational assignments?
So a couple thoughts on this. I think teaching at West Point and being here at the academy as a junior officer coming out of company command, very much the same position that you guys are in, was a great assignment for me at the right time. I believe that when I left here as a better officer than when I first showed up here. I attribute that, frankly, to the folks that I was around that helped make me better. I mean, collectively, we realized that we had a great opportunity to take the 2 to 3 years that most of us were here to really expand ourselves professionally as leaders. So I think, you know, any of these broadening assignments, obviously you want to be better than when you left, but certainly being here at West Point, I thought was good for me. I've had the benefit of getting a degree, an advanced degree in sociology, which, at least with what I studied in sociology, has been almost directly applicable to what I do, what I've done as a leader, and that's groups, group dynamics, conflict resolution, obviously diversity. So you learn a lot of those things, principles that you can certainly apply as a leader and as a commander. And then lastly, some of the research I did was on networks and insurgent networks, which frankly I was able to almost directly apply in subsequent deployments as I tried to piece together enemy networks and also sort of governance networks, economic networks, all that kind of stuff. So at least for me, the application was almost direct.
So we'll definitely include Colonel Reed's dissertation or a link to it in our show notes. And last question for graduate school or ACS. This is more of a career management question, I think. Do you have any words of advice to those captains listening who are considering applying for graduate school and or ACS?
Yeah, I would tell you to absolutely apply. As I mentioned earlier, I think you're only going to be better coming out of it. And you also bring something to the classroom. So don't underestimate what you bring to the classroom. Now, I will also tell you that a lot of folks have concerns about timelines and how does this fit in terms of what I want to do in the Army. I don't mean to make this sound reckless, and hopefully it doesn't come across that way, but do what you want to do and do it well, and you'll be just fine. And that, frankly, has held true for me, to be honest with you. Timing has always worked out for me, and I've been pretty fortunate in that respect. So now you'll have to work with your branch manager and all these other types of things, but I would absolutely tell you if you want to do that, go for it, and you'll be better because of it.
So sort of shift focus from leader development, let's talk about training in a fiscally constrained environment. So the Secretary of the Army's directive, Every Dollar Counts, calls for a change in the way we manage spending. The days of use or lose all your budget are gone. And for me, when I was a company commander, I was an ESC commander, so we did engineer support company, so we did light airfield repair and also horizontal engineering. I used to joke to steal from a line that I had 99 problems and 136 of them were in the motor pool. But that's to say that during sequestration, when we went out to train, I had to account for not only the usage of vehicles and the future maintenance, but how much we were using in fuel consumptions and rations, and leverage that against my metal assessment and the training impact training would have. You coming from a striker brigade, what kind of guidance did you give your commanders when balancing training requirements with sustainment requirements such as maintenance and equipping the force?
We obviously have a responsibility to be good stewards of our money and our resources. I mean, that goes without saying. I think everyone's intention to do that, but some people are better than others at doing it. In a good formation, you're going to have budgeting guidance because money is finite. So the commander is going to establish priorities. Unfortunately, as a company commander, you're sort of at the end of that green tab chain. So you're going to have to work within the priorities established by your boss and your boss's boss. So number one is stay within the budgeting guidance. I think that's my first piece of advice that I would pass along. But number two is have the foresight to know what you'll need and when you're going to need it. You might want a new piece of kit right now, when in reality is you could probably do without it and spend that money somewhere else within the commander's priorities. For that particular point in time. And if there's a lack of clarity on things, you know, ask yourself, do I really need to spend the money on this now? Is this money well spent? And the good example that I will use is a scope. There's so many cool guy scopes out there that everyone wants one for the rifle. Fact of the matter is the Army's got a couple pretty good scopes themselves that are on your property book. So the money that you might spend on this cool guy scope, frankly, and it may be within the budgeting guidance, might be money well spent on something else, you know, doing something training-wise, sustainment-wise, whatever. So that's probably the best piece of advice I can give you is, you know, give yourself a reality check if you need to spend that on this piece of kit or this item. But again, stay within your commander's budget and priorities.
Yes, that's a good point. And I guess there's also hidden costs to training, things that you don't see right off the bat. So we had aging engineer equipment and schools as well. If I take a piece of equipment out to the field, the likelihood that it's going to stay 10-20 by the time it comes out of the field is low. So bringing that back up to 10-20 standards is going to cost me X amount of dollars at the end of the training.
Yeah, and somebody's got to pay for the porta potties. I mean, that is money. And your brigade will, if it's a brigade event or your battalion event, I mean, I hate to make this about porta potties, but the truth of the matter is somebody's got to pay for them, and it's coming out of somebody's budget. And if you're running your own exercise, you're paying for it. So again, cool guy scope or porta potties.
So note to our listeners, do not forget about the porta potties. But more to your point, it's not something that I understood until I took company command. The budgeting that goes into training and equipping. Sometimes we had to postpone on shortages just because we needed money for parts, money for services, and so on. So continuing on training, one of our biggest exposures to the brigade commander was during a quarterly training brief. We would brief training statistics, schools, medal analysis, training calendar, and then a highlighted training event for the quarter. What was your area of focus in a QTB?
So good units are going to do company QTBs. And as you mentioned, you know, company commanders will get an opportunity to brief their brigade commander prior to the battalion commander's briefing the division commander. And so in our formation, like many formations, you get your standard set of slides, which talks all the statistics of marksmanship, fitness, medal analysis, exactly as you highlighted. For me, what I was primarily looking for with the company commanders was where they nested with their boss and nested with me. That's frankly probably the biggest thing that I was most concerned about was, are they nested with my guidance and with our priorities? The second thing was the medal analysis, how they assess themselves. I was less concerned, to be honest with you, whether they assess themselves as a P or a T or a U, because there is a subjective nature to it, although there isn't there are objective measures, but more concerned with how they were good to address those challenges. And then lastly, their highlighted training event, that was, you know, we always had them highlight one particular training event for that quarter coming up. I was always interested in why that particular event was one that they highlighted. And again, how that's tied to where they see themselves in their medal analysis. The last thing that was important to me was truly, how can I help? Because company QTBs were obviously an opportunity for company commanders to highlight some issues of friction that I might not be aware of. And obviously, if their boss hadn't heard about it before, that always caused for an interesting environment. But the bottom line was, there were things that I could apply some 06 juice to unstick, if that's a word, a problem that they couldn't help. So just a couple thoughts there.
This was definitely a question that we should have asked in my battalion, our brigade commander. We would spend just about all our effort on the highlighted training event, which was one slide at the end, and the brigade commander would spend about 45 minutes per company on the training statistics. And we obviously, the first go-around, didn't understand what he was looking for, and finally our battalion commander pointed it out that we try to make the slide that shows our highlighted training event, you know, pop out and impress the brigade commander. But what he was looking for is how we're doing training, how do we assess ourselves, and can we support ourselves in a training environment? So
the statistics are important, obviously, when you're talking about marksmanship and schools. In Alaska, obviously, we were worried about you know, how many folks were qualified at the cold weather leader course, basic mountaineering, and then fitness. Now, I always looked at the slides ahead of time. Obviously, you know, we get a pre-read. So we would deep dive on a couple of those issues if if something was out of balance, you know, if you weren't meeting, you know, the requirements for 100% CLS or whatever the case may be. Each commander is going to be different in terms of where they want to focus. So understanding that prior to going in, I think is helpful. So it's a good discussion.
From what I understand also is now there's a shift towards objective T in training where the medal assessments has always been somewhat subjective. And that with USR, they don't really talk, but now we're going into, in order to rate a T in a collective task, you have to show the conditions are met. You know, whether it be, have we done the live fire or not, or how many people were present for the training, being able to account for that is going to go into your medal assessment, and not just a subjective from the commander's point of view, how the unit is doing.
I'll just add on to the QTB discussion. One thing that I thought was very effective and useful for me visually was the forcing function of including my vehicle services and cyclic inventories across my quarterly training week. So I knew whether my pacing item or what other vehicle services were going on that week. If we're going to the field, we could shift left or right based on that 10% of the service window, which weeks would be my more intensive supply demand weeks. And if you don't get that on the calendar, if you don't have some sort of system in place, you're very reactive in a sense, and you're going to be spending a lot of time in the motor pool or not prepared to roll out for a 5-day FTX.
That's a great point. I mean, services are a training event. They've got to be accounted for on the calendar. Obviously, your training schedule's got to be built about around when you go into services. You know, in a striker brigade, you're obviously a wheel formation. So you've got a lot of strikers, and you got a lot of other kind of kit that has to be serviced. So making sure that was on the calendar, accounted for. And then I don't want to make this about services and maintenance, but, you know, one other point to all that is services were briefed, you know, from the lowest level up through the battalion commander. And then frequently as a brigade commander, I would sit in on a brigade maintenance meeting, which obviously adds a little bit of emphasis, command emphasis in terms of the importance of it. And then it'd be interesting to see how many battalion commanders would start showing up when the brigade commander was there. But it's a great point. I mean, you got to account for that.
That's just the former BMO and S4 and me, sir, coming out. So, sir, back in episode 4, interviewed Wes Lafitte, and he had the opportunity to establish or stand up two companies. And we talked a lot about culture and organizational climate. And obviously, AR-600-20 explicitly states that the commander is responsible for establishing leadership climate of the unit and developing a disciplined and cohesive unit. So in your opinion, and obviously with your background in sociology, what are the characteristics of a healthy unit culture or climate at the company level?
The there's a saying, I'm sure you've heard it before. I mean, I probably stole it from somebody, but you know, good units do routine things routinely. I think that goes a long way when you think about a culture and a climate and an organization. If units are doing routine things routinely, it means they have good systems and processes in place. It means people are being held to a standard. It means you've got leaders checking. Obviously, you got soldiers doing. And I'm not just talking about administrative type stuff. I'm talking about training being accomplished, routine things, running a range, done routinely, done very well. So, you know, there's a level of fitness in an organization. There's respect for people's opinions and views on things. So I'm always cautious about trying to put a box around what good culture looks like, because frankly, it could look a little bit different in each organization. And I'm also very cautious about using statistics to judge whether or not a unit has a good culture or not. Number of chapters and UCMJ, that could mean either A, you got a really jacked up unit. It could mean that you're holding people's standards and that's why you got so many. If you don't have enough, does that mean that you're just looking the other way? So you got to be careful about whether or not that's a good measure of a good culture. But really, I kind of simplify it in that good units do routine things routinely, because that means a lot if you really start to peel the onion back. I'm not sure that's a completely satisfying answer, but I am cautious about putting a box around what good culture looks like.
Sir, it's definitely a tough concept, and one thing I've tried to talk to my cadet chain of command a lot about is This concept of the better we are at managing systems within the company, the more time and I think psychological space we offer ourselves to really lead people. So the better we are at managing, the better, the more time and space and energy we can have it at leadership. We haven't really talked about command teams and the CEO and first sergeant relationship, so I want to ensure that we touch on that subject because it is definitely critical to the success of an organization. So my follow-up to my culture and climate question would be, sir, is how do command teams as a team foster a healthy culture?
So as I mentioned at the beginning, I've been shaped by several great non-commissioned officers. I've just really been fortunate in that respect, and I think that I learned a lot about what it means to be a good command team. You've obviously got to be in sync with one another, but at the end of the day, there's only one commander in an organization, and you know your senior enlisted leader obviously recognizes that. But at least thinking about my time as a brigade commander and then as a battalion commander, I felt like I was very much in sync with my sergeant major. We didn't always see eye to eye, but we certainly were in sync in terms of our priorities and what we were trying to do with the battalion or brigade and move it forward. And that trickles down. That trickles down to the lowest level, not just to battalion commanders and sergeant majors, but company commanders and first sergeants. We often were seen together, although obviously we would split forces at times to go do and check on different things. But being synced, I think, is important in terms of setting the priorities for the formation. You know, the other piece about command teams fostering a healthy culture is they've obviously got to lead by example. And this goes back to one of my initial points of, you know, you can't be hypocritical in terms of how you're leading your formation. If you truly value people's opinion on things, then truly value it, because they'll see right through it that you're just checking the block because you think, yeah, I need to ask their opinion, but I don't really care. So, I mean, if you truly believe in empowering people and seeking their feedback, I think that's important to do that. The other thing I would tell you is I tried to share with my folks was, you know, be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So you want to encourage folks to bring ideas to you and, you know, identify deficiencies in something, but to be helpful in terms of solving that problem. And, you know, the more that you interact with your subordinates and your soldiers, and you know they start to get a sense that, hey, this person's authentic and really kind of cares about me, believes in what I'm having to say, and I think overall it helps to foster a healthy culture. I mean, my sergeant major and I talk quite a bit to our commanders and first sergeants and soldiers, and I think it made a difference. But I think the thing I would leave you with is, at the end of the day, be a leader. I mean, lead your formation.
I think that's timeless advice, sir, for all the company commanders out there. So our last question is on the topic of learning agility, and I think it applies a lot to the company commander who wears, frankly, a lot of hats, from counselor to command authority to having to know a little bit about logistics, a lot about supply, training management. And I wonder if you could offer our listeners what from your research did you learn about learning agility, and specifically how it applies in the Army context at the company level.
So in the interest of full disclosure, this is not any idea that I came up with. Someday when you guys go to the Senior Service College, whether you go to the brick and mortar at Carlisle or Rhode Island or wherever, or if you go to a fellowship, you'll have an advisor, because you got to write a paper, and your advisor will strongly recommend this might be a good topic for you to write on. So that was sort of my case when I went to Columbia. And I was also very fortunate that I went to Columbia and studied under Dr. Burke, who, you know, is sort of the guru in organizational leadership, so very helpful. So his project at the time, or one of his initiatives, was this idea of learning agility, which admittedly I really knew nothing about. And then as I peeled the onion back on it, I realized, wow, this is really applicable to who we are and what we do as Army officers. So in a nutshell, I mean, learning agility is about seeking new learning opportunities and ways of – well, let me back up for a second. In a nutshell, learning agility is about a learning organization and a learning culture. There are kind of three things that sort of are tied to learning agility. One is seeking new learning opportunities and ways of doing things. I mean, you could stay in your comfort zone and, you know, really kind of enjoy life and move forward, or you can seek opportunities that might stress your assumptions, might stress you yourself, cause you to be a bit uncomfortable. But at the end of the day, you know, is good for your growth professionally and personally. Obviously, you need to perform in these challenging situations, which is the second behavior. Perform to a degree that there's some growth and learning from it, which leads to the third behavior, and frankly, the most important, and that's reflection. Just like you get together after a rotation at the NTC or JRTC and you do an AAR, I mean, that reflection piece, as you self-reflect on how you performed in that particular situation, is ultimately what's going to grow you professionally. I, you know, frankly, though, that briefs well. But if you work in an organization that doesn't promote learning and is not a learning organization, admittedly, that's going to be difficult, because to really do this right, you've got to have an environment. You can't be risk averse. If there's an environment of risk aversion, it's going to be hard to grow, because when we grow, we make mistakes. So you've got to be able to underwrite mistakes and be prepared to underwrite those mistakes. Obviously, when we're in combat, completely different situation. But when we're here at West Point, when we're training, when we're kind of getting ready to go, those are the times that you want to create this learning agility in your leaders. So that's it in a nutshell. But it was very helpful to me, frankly, and I tried to carry some of that forward as a brigade commander and what I did in my brigade.
So I'm glad you brought that concept of an AAR. We could do a whole podcast episode on how to run good AARs. And frankly, I was surprised and encouraged to see how many books or research papers we read during our grad school experience cited the Army AAR process as a way of organizational learning or double, triple loop learning. So, sir, I really want to thank you for your time today. You've added a lot of value to the discussion here on the podcast. We'll capture a lot of this stuff in the show notes. And, just thank you for your time. You're welcome back, obviously, anytime, the Leaders Huddle. I hope the company commanders out there have taken some of their notes in their green notebook, and reach out to us if you want any access to some of these resources we mentioned.
I really appreciate the opportunity. You got company commanders are literally at the tip of the spear. Those of us were in 06 rank and 05 rank at the brigade and battalion level, you were obviously engaged in the fight. But at the end of the day, it's company commanders and first sergeants that ultimately are going to get it done. It's literally where the rubber meets the road. So never, ever underestimate the impact that you're having on soldiers and your leaders.
All right, thanks again, sir. This wraps up today's Leaders Huddle podcast. In the next episode, we take a deeper look into using coaching as a method of leader development by interviewing a trained executive coach and former member of the Caldell team, Major Retired Jonathan Silk. You can connect with us at iTunes, and we're also on the Google Play platform. We want to hear from you, our listeners, on the topics you'd like us to discuss, so please leave a comment on iTunes or through the Caldell-sponsored Facebook page at Company Command, and the Twitter handle at @CO_CMD. Until next time, remember that elevating your performance and unleashing your potential as a leader. The views expressed in the Leaders Huddle podcast are the opinions of the hosts and guests. The discussion shared here does not represent the official position of the United States Military Academy or the U.S. Army.